Let's have another chat about the Australian election. As we heard earlier, the campaign didn't start well for Labor leader Anthony Albanese, not knowing what the cash rate was. And although it got better for him, obviously, there were still awkward moments, like when he was asked several times at a press conference if there'd be high deficits under Labor, but he sidestepped the question.
Those investments will lead to higher productivity. And those investments under Labor. Well, you get to ask a question, then I get to answer it. That's the other part of the deal here. You get to ask the question, I get to answer it. The question is, will there be higher productivity under Labor? Well, what we will have is a fiscally responsible policy.
Ross Stitt is a Kiwi, a former tax lawyer, now a freelance writer based in Sydney with a PhD in political science. And he's joining us this morning. Kia ora, Ross.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk to you. We'll talk about what Mr. Albanese will face. But first, he did it. He got his party over the line so he can bask in the glow and the acclaim for a little while at least.
Yes, well, you wouldn't say he did it well. His primary vote was lower than the previous election. The big surprise here was the success of the independents and the miners. Labor has got there really through the preferential voting system rather than through primary first preferences.
There's still a chance they'll get there. They'll get the seats, though, isn't there? They'll get the 76 seats for recount.
I think the ABC, which is probably the primary core of the position, has got them at 72 votes at the moment. They need 76. They may get to majority government, but even if they're a minority, clearly they can work with the Teal independents and with the Greens. They're sort of ideologically similar.
Yes, indeed. Was it an entertaining campaign? I mean, there was Mr. Albanese forgetting the bank rate at the very start. There was the odd funny quip from him. For example, asking where the government ministers were they in witness protection, which was a good line.
Yeah.
But overall, what? Was it a fairly grim battle in fairly grim times?
It was pretty dispiriting, I think, for most people. People were over Morrison, particularly with women voters, and Albanese was pretty unimpressive, really, the number of gaffes he made. So you couldn't be particularly enthused by the election campaign, and that was reflected in the result, really. A record number of people voting for independents and miners. Really, it's a move slowly away from the traditional two-party model.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. There was just too much going against Scott Morrison this time, such as, please.
Well, clearly the cost of living was the biggest problem. He had both a record inflation number for decades of 5.1%, then he had an increase by the Reserve Bank of the cash rate. Very hard to overcome that if you're the government. It's cost of living goes up, people blame the government. And in addition to that, of course, the coalition had been in power for 9 years. There's always an element of time for change. Yeah. So things were always going to go Labor's way, I think you'd have to say.
To what extent did all the accusations against Scott Morrison personally have an effect? His being untrustworthy and a bully and an autocrat, and some of this coming from within the ranks of the right, because he manifests an ordinary bloke image at odds with that. So his humility towards the end of the campaign was what? It was too little too late.
Yes, he was really trying to change his personality. You're right, he comes across, I imagine, to a New Zealander watching the campaign, you'd think he's quite a nice guy. He's a very good campaigner, works well in schoolyards and supermarkets. But at that point in time, I think he's just become too unpopular, particularly with women. He's had a problem with women throughout. The government has always had a focus on tradies, sport, just tends to have more of a male focus, I think. They've always had a problem in the Liberal Party getting reasonable numbers of candidates, women candidates, and collectively over time that's worked against them. Then there were problems with sexual harassment in Parliament. It just collectively became too much, and there was a major shift of women against Morrison in particular, I think, and against the Liberal Party. And that's what the Teal independents benefited from also in the wealthy inner city seats.
That's right, they did, certainly. He was also remote, though, literally. Like, he was in Hawaii on holiday during the 2019 fires. And was that possibly a misstep for voters who probably do have long memories about some things?
That was a misstep. I'm not sure the voters have such long-term memories about that sort of thing, but it kept coming up in the campaign. Some of the major cartoonists, they now always when they draw Scott Morrison, they'll often draw him with a Hawaiian shirt on. So it's amazing how a thing like that, which was several years ago now, can just keep coming up. And it's brought up in the election campaign. And yes, it became difficult to overcome. When you combine with the fact we then subsequently had major floods, and it was very easy for the opposition to criticise him for not coming quickly enough to the rescue of people suffering from major flooding. And so that built on the Hawaiian problem.
So climate change figured largely, especially in the in Queensland and in those inner city urban seats. We know this. Management of COVID, a listener wants to know about, as a factor. Did people vote on that, do you think?
That's very hard to say. Perhaps the best sign that COVID was influenced in the election was actually the result in Western Australia, which was almost something of a landslide for the Labor Party. Usually it's a stronghold for the coalition, and Labor really picked up a lot of seats in Western Australia. And that was the electorate that was really most like New Zealand. The Labor state government, Mark McGowan, was really closed even after New Zealanders started to open up. And he received a lot of support for that locally. You know, most Western Australians were reasonably happy to be safe, albeit isolated from the rest of Australia and the world. You know, Western Australia is a different part of Australia, really. They just send their coal and their iron ore to the rest of the world and make a lot of money. And they often talk about secession from the rest of Australia. And this was an example. I mean, in fact, you saw it throughout the country. There was a reasonable swing towards the Liberal Party in Tasmania. There was a swing towards Labor, big time, Western Australia. Queensland, one of the biggest winners, was the Greens Party.
Yeah.
And in New South Wales, the biggest swing was to the Teal Independents. So it was a very mixed bag across the country.
Yeah, it is an interesting mixed bag election, isn't it? Anthony Albanese has been an MP for 26 years. He may not be presidential, and we know it's purportedly an era of charismatic leaders, but I wonder if he projects at least a kind of plain-spoken honesty and a seeming devotion to duty, Ross, that's enough.
That's what he tries to do. I mean, in his acceptance speech last night, he referred to the fact that he had come from a public housing with a solo mother, a very difficult upbringing, but like John Key in some respects, I suppose, but he makes more of it, Albanese, saying that, you know, it shows you that anyone, any child in Australia can become the Prime Minister, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think that a lot of people would say, you know, if they had to go to the pub with Morrison or Albanese, they'd always pick Albanese. He's more down to earth, nice guy. Is that enough on the international stage? He's heading off to Tokyo on Monday to meet with the leaders of India, Japan and the United States for what's called the Quad, which is a balancing exercise against China. And the question is, how will he play on the big stage? But you're right, domestically, a lot of people will be comfortable with a reasonably quiet Australian, as you might call him.
The cost of living across the ditch must have been a huge issue, as it is everywhere, and just about everywhere. And Labor adopted a small target approach. They pretty well promised the same kind of benevolence as the Liberals.
Yeah, I mean, that's in some respects, a sad aspect of the politics, and it may tell you why the independents and miners have done so well. At the end of the day, it was very hard to distinguish Labor from the coalition. Now, of course, you get extremists on both sides of the left and right that would say that's not right, and there's a huge difference between Labor and the coalition. But if you actually look at the final costings of their respective budgets, they're remarkably similar, and that was Labor's way of getting into power, really, not saying anything too outrageous, anything that might lose them votes. So cost of living really brought down the coalition rather than elected Albanese. You're right also to point out climate change. I'm surprised. I think climate change was a bigger issue in the outcome than we thought. It's been an issue that sort of has bedeviled the coalition, but they managed to survive it over the years because they always fudge the issue, really. They don't want to do a lot about it. But on this occasion, I think the move both to the Teal Independents and to the Greens shows you that it was actually a big part of the voting decision by a lot of voters, and it cost the Liberals a lot of seats. And that's probably hasn't actually cost them that many votes in the past. I think this time it did. And that was shown in the ABC Vote Compass survey, which indicated that climate change was the biggest issue in the election. I thought that was surprising, given cost of living issues, but It does seem to have indicated that does seem to be the case given the Teals and the Greens results.
And we talked a bit about the Teal Independents earlier in the morning. Ross Stitt is with us. So Labor, getting back to those costings, Labor will spend more on aged care, on health and education, national disability insurance. The Sydney Morning Herald analysed Labor's costings, $11.5 billion in cuts and new revenue sources, but with election commitments costing $18.9 billion, deepening the budget deficit by $7.4 billion over 4 years. And this is the same newspaper that said, I think, that Morrison's government needed to go. And Mr Albanese reckoned encouraging more women to enter the workforce would help boost productivity. But as one economist put it, whoever wins, debts and deficits await. So with a cynical eye, because he's supported a wage increase of more than 5% to keep up with inflation, with a cynical eye, Ross, wage increases are something of a mirage longer term, but if voters think they can outrun inflation shorter term, that's enough?
Well, that's right. Like, people think that, well, if I can get my 5.1%, I'll be okay. But the trouble is you then get a wage price spiral and you get higher inflation. At the end of the day, most people suffer if you get long-term ingrained inflation. So there's no doubt that under a Labor government, there'll be more allowance for an increase in wages and salaries. Obviously, the unions support Labor and they will expect to get higher pay increases. Similarly, the public service will expect to get higher pay increases. Albanese effectively said that he's in favour of a 5.1% increase for the minimum wage. So that will definitely push up Australia's inflation going forward. One of the problems with both parties really was that they weren't prepared to admit that fiscal stimulus in terms of government spending really just contributes to more inflation. And neither party was prepared to countenance any kind of expenditure cuts, because obviously that would be a vote loser. So in a way, you've got this odd situation that the Reserve Bank's trying to get inflation under control by putting up interest rates. At the same time, the government's spending more and more money, which is feeding the same inflation. So it's a tricky one. But yeah, there's no doubt that we've got debt and deficits for a long time to come. I think I saw the other day in the New Zealand budget that you're looking at returning to surplus in 2025. Well, we're not looking to return to surplus any time in the next 6 to 10 years, I would have said.
And there'd been a lot of debt already under the coalition, hadn't they? I was reading that 15 million Australians got handouts of one sort or another.
That's right. Very cynically, the coalition tried to argue that that was a response to COVID, but the reality was that they weren't running surpluses before COVID struck anyway. So that they talked fiscal responsibility and tax cuts and the rest of it, but like so many centre-right parties, in order to win elections, they can't afford to cut expenditure, so they don't balance the books, and you end up with, yes, we're heading towards, so we, even without the Labor government, we were heading towards $1 trillion government debt. So that's going to get worse and worse for the foreseeable future. And I don't think that Labor will seek to bring it under control. But that's not an uncommon view now around the world, that somehow the governments, you know, modern monetary theory, governments can spend money and there's really no downside to it. But in high inflation times, there is some argument that inflation will get rid of your debt, but it's still it's an abandonment of where earlier Labor governments and John Howard governments were, which was to try and be fiscally responsible and balance the budget.
A question from a listener, Morena Jim. The ALP policy, as I understand it, to make it easier for Kiwis living in Oz to achieve residency and citizenship, a question to put to Ross Stitt. Yes, Ross, the effect on the brain drain here, there's a theory espoused that Kiwis will go to Oz for better money, replacing Australians who are also fleeing the country to some extent for more money internationally.
Yeah, well, in terms of Australians going overseas, it tends to be sort of higher skilled professionals, lawyers, accountants that can go to Hong Kong, London, that traditional story. You don't tend to see Australian tradies and those sorts of people going overseas. So I think that's more of a risk in New Zealand, that you'll get the less highly paid people leaving New Zealand. Those people don't tend to leave Australia because they can still have a pretty good life in Adelaide, Brisbane, Gold Coast, et cetera, and earn pretty good money. Those aren't the people going to New York and London, obviously. So, you will see more of a brain drain. And that's a bigger risk for New Zealand with the Labor government, because in the short term, at least, wages and salaries are likely to go up faster in Australia than they would otherwise have done under the coalition. Hard one to tell. And prices will go up as well. So maybe our inflation rate will get closer to yours.
The attitude taken by the Australian government towards China, which it was said earlier in the morning, you know, may not change all that much, but perhaps the level of aggression might. that attitude seemed to play well in polling from what I read. But then the surprise announcement of a possible Chinese military base in the Solomon Islands came along, and Mr. Albanese was able to characterise this as a massive foreign policy failure, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah, that was. I think it was a small winner for the Labor Party. National security tends to have been a vote winner traditionally for the coalition. You go back to the days of John Howard being George Bush's deputy sheriff in the days of Iraq and Afghanistan, etc. And Labor's always made a point of just trying to stick closely to whatever the coalition says, so it's not to sort of allow a gap there. Nevertheless, no doubt that Albanese, and in particular the expected foreign minister, Penny Wong, who is of Chinese descent, that they will take a more softly approach with China. And for a lot of people, particularly some of the people that trade with China, that won't be a bad thing. There's a lot of suspicion that in Australia, Morrison and Dutton have been particularly antagonistic towards China for domestic politics reasons, which is obviously not a good way to do things. One of the really interesting things that the ABC was reporting on last night was that in the electorates with the highest Chinese immigrant populations, there was a much bigger swing against the coalition than there was nationwide. Mm-hmm. And there's been some suggestion that local Chinese immigrants have responded badly to the coalition's antagonism towards China and have therefore moved away from voting for the coalition, which is an interesting one. There'll be a lot more research done on that one.
Yeah, it is interesting. Speaking of who's going to fill whose shoes, who's going to succeed Scott Morrison?
Yeah, well, that of course, is one of the most interesting issues. Probably the most significant thing in last night's election, if you're taking a long-term view of it, is that the left wing, if you can call it that, of the coalition, of the Liberal Party, disappeared. A big part of the coalition's base. In Sydney, for example, most of the prime harbourfront's electorates, Wentworth, Northern Sydney, Warringah, have gone from the coalition to these things called Teal Independents. Now, these are the wealthiest suburbs in Australia. This is like the Remuera and the Fendletons of Australia. And they have now all shifted, well, most of them have shifted from being absolute, you know, decades-long coalition seats to these Teal Independents. And that's a reflection of these wealthy suburbs place much greater emphasis on climate change as an issue, much greater emphasis on integrity and accountability in politics, and on gender issues. So that's a challenge for the coalition. It's effectively lost its left flank, and very hard to see how it can win as a centrist party without that. And that's repeated, of course, in the now leadership issue. Morrison's already resigned. His expected heir, Josh Frydenberg, who was in the Kooyong seat, once again, decades-long Liberal seat, and it was held by Sir Robert Menzies, the founder of the Liberal Party, for decades. Now, Frydenberg lost his seat to a Teal Independent. So now the likely candidate then to lead the Liberal Party and therefore the coalition is now Peter Dutton, who is an absolute hawk on China. He's the person that announced that New Zealand needs to prepare for war against China. He's a conservative as opposed to a small L Liberal. So the likelihood is that he will take the Liberal Party and the coalition more to the right. And hard to see how they can return to power from the right. They really need to be a centrist party. So that's a real challenge in terms of leadership. I can't identify anyone immediately that's going to have a reasonable chance of beating Peter Dutton. So a lot of people, in fact, there's a lot of people that would be very depressed at the prospect of Australia's two major parties being led by Albanese and Dutton. They are not, arguably, the best candidates for the job.
I don't know if there's any proverbial wisdom about how people's voting has more focus in tough times and they dabble less, but it hasn't been true here, has it? Labor battling to keep the intellectual inner city vote, Liberals not holding on to inner city prosperous voters, as you say, and I'm told, according to the polling pre-election anyway, some rural voters too. So it has been a curious result in that sense, hasn't it?
It has. No, it's you know, those are the words we used last night: messy, fragmented, weird. Traditionally, this is a two-party system, and the elections usually they have a pendulum model, and the pendulum swings left or right. That just isn't the case this time. There's now legitimate third and fourth movements or parties: the Greens, the Teal Independents, and different moves all over the country. So the electorate's much more difficult to read. I mean, it's interesting looking at the New Zealanders. You've obviously got MMP, which in some respects copes better with that kind of split. But you've still got the reasonably traditional Greens, Labour versus ACT National. Whereas here we've seen a bit of a breakdown of that. The other factor you need to have taken into account in Australia, of course, is we've got a Senate. And the Senate is the upper house. Now, I won't begin to explain the voting system there. It's immensely complicated and it takes days and days to work out who the winners are. But the early indications are that for the first time, there'll be what's called a progressive majority in the Senate. That will be a combination of Labour, the Greens, and these Teal and some of the other independents. And that will make it easier for Labour to get their legislation through the House, which is usually an obstacle to any government to get things through the Senate. Interesting issue for New Zealanders is that that probably from the ACT, a new senator will be the rugby player David Pocock, who will be well known to a lot of New Zealanders.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He's quite a progressive. I mean, he's most famous for saying that he wouldn't get married to his girlfriend until Australia brought in same-sex marriage laws, and that's indeed what he did.
That's right.
He is a strong progressive and very popular in the ACT, and it looks like he has made it into the Senate for the ACT, which is an interesting turn of events. But that's an example of the progressive nature of the Senate and an example of the diverse, increasingly diverse nature of Australian politics, moving away from that old two-party system.
Yeah. Morena, Jim, could you please ask Ross if Labour has a policy on New Zealand deportees and 501s? We did touch on this earlier in the morning. What do you think? Will there be any kind of noticeable change here or even a gradual sympathetic change?
I don't think there'll be a dramatic change because Albanese won't want to be sort of accused of going soft on national security too quickly because this is partly seen, oddly enough, as a national security issue. But I think there probably will be a gradual movement. There was reporting in one of the newspapers, I think it was on Thursday and Friday, about talk of an introduction of a better character test, whereby if someone has lived in Australia for a long period of time, there may be more of an assessment of their character to determine whether or not they should be allowed to change. Also, I think probably you'll get a better hearing from the Greens party. And to the extent it's not clear, the Greens will have somewhere between 2 and 5 seats in the House, and they will certainly have good representation in the Senate. So the combination of the Greens' influence on a softer Labor Party, I would expect to see some softening on the 501 issue, but don't expect anything overnight.
Is this a good election to win, or to use that phrase again for the second time this morning, the proverbial poison chalice?
No, I think it is. It's a poison chalice, really. When you look at inflation's going up, interest rates are going up, Labor's inherited a huge deficit and a rising deficit. Obviously we've got the ongoing problems with China, we've got the war in Ukraine. It's a very difficult time to form government. So the one saving grace for Labor is that they will have a Senate that should be reasonably friendly towards Labor legislation. But that, of course, that could contribute to getting Labor into trouble. But, you know, it's not a good time to win an election. And so the Liberal Party will obviously be disappointed. But I'm sure they'll be aware of that fact that they were staring a whole lot of problems in the face themselves. So, but they've got the bigger issue of they've got to sort out what's happening to their party, what's happened to the left wing of the Liberal Party.
And a lot of pressure, of course, because on the other hand, climate change, more front and centre, Indigenous voices and practices heard more clearly, all that
stuff.
Well,
the Indigenous issue is one that was immediately referred to by Albanese in his acceptance speech. And that's something they're going to move forward on reasonably quickly, which is something the coalition wasn't going to entertain. So we may well, we're still not clear what form that will take. We may see some kind of national referendum on a voice to parliament, who knows, on a treaty recognition in the constitution. But that's an issue that will definitely move much faster than it would otherwise have done. Yeah.
All right. Nice to talk to you, Ross. Thank you for your time and your expertise on a Sunday morning.
Great talking to you, Jim. Thanks very much.